So, welcome everyone. Now, I know I made fewer homework sheets than there are people in the room, and yet the stack is still half filled. So, most of you take it off the web, right? Okay, all right. Whatever. So, we're in the middle of a series of about six talks in one discussion. People asked or have asked why we haven't done the usual talk discussion, and it's because I have to get them all in before June, because we have a series of people coming in June, and so we just have time for just one discussion. And I'm hoping to do that after the refraining from unwise speech. So, but this week it's refraining from taking that which is not offered. And just a plug for the benefits of the precepts. I have to plug it every time, it seems. It's some people feel that it is sort of the basics of the teaching. I mean, I take it when I'm on retreat often. It's you get it in the beginning class. You get it right along the way, and often we don't give it really consideration. And I can remember in my own practice having that very thing, thinking that mindfulness, I'm going towards mindfulness and the rest will just have to fall in place. And my behavior remained rather coarse and unaligned with that mindfulness. But I felt if I just did it long enough, that everything would sort of fold in. And I think that's the wrong way to think about practice. I think the better way to do it, and to save yourself a lot of time, is to think that each quality of practice is a hologram of the whole of the teaching, as is mindfulness, as is awareness. One way to perceive it as an aspect of what a free mind is like, and that the Buddha probably just talked about different aspects of how he saw the world, so that the teaching is not piecemeal. It's not available at the way that most of our minds engage in it. And we can get lost in that engagement because on the other side, or the near enemy of each of these precepts, is shame. And we've all been down that road in our religious traditions. And I just want to make sure that we don't fall that way again, because it's really adharmic. It's going against the movement of growth. So we have to be very perceptive of how we hold these precepts, because they're really a call for greater sensitivity. If we think about it, we all have great large areas of ourselves that are very coarse and very unavailable to the world, to noticing things. These gross areas are called ignorance, areas of just blindness, where we're just running on automatic pilot. And we can look at the precepts as a call towards a greater perception, a greater sensitivity to both how we hold ourselves and also interact with each other. And in the so doing, when we carry a precept down into its subtlety, we really begin to see the very subtle layers on which our ignorance layers itself. So the precepts are a call to pay attention, you might say. And so we pick out different aspects of how we don't pay attention. The swatting of the mosquito. But now we're into one that is not taking what isn't offered. And it does work. I mean, I don't want to, as we begin to practice and mature in our practice, we take these things on as areas of investigation. Let me see how it is that I'm not taking what isn't offered. Let me see how it is that I am more interested in self-concern than I am in replenishing. That's another way of saying it. And as we practice over and over again, over the long weeks and months and years, there is an effect, almost cellularly, in that we don't have to investigate anymore. It becomes automatic in the sense that our perceptions are so soft and unfixed that the sensitivity of heart is lived in an ongoing way. At that point, even though there may be a great deal of ignorance that still encumbers the system, there's a level of non-harm that we cannot do, that we cannot cross. And at a certain point in practice, after a number of deep spiritual insights, we basically hold ourselves and live non-harm, not as any rules or regulations, not as any sense of pretension or even being spiritual. It's just that the view of how it is that we relate to others and the world at large and ourselves has crossed a threshold in which harm can no longer enter. Doesn't mean we don't have periods of absence and ignorance. Doesn't mean we don't say things that are coarse or that we don't do some of the infractions of the subtleties of the precepts, but non-harm is the basis on which we live. Perhaps one of the first inclinations or indications that that is happening is that you, at some point in the practice, really don't want to hurt anyone anymore. You don't have that intention. You don't have that intention. I mean, you may get angry and say, boy, just wait till I, all that, but it's never carried out in action. Or the intention just stays as kind of a thought base. And you feel it, realize that this is just a perceptual way, having experienced enough pain in my own life through my practice and become more and more sensitive to how I impact others and seeing the pain of that and knowing the pain of the human consciousness, that I don't want to do that anymore. And I suggest examining our life to see if that is how we hold life, because it should be. Most of us in the room have done enough practice where that should be the basis for our intentionality. So, an example, I was at IMS, and I did a workshop for the staff, and they gave me a stipend, or whatever you call those things, honorarium, I think it was called, of $300 for doing this. And one day they put a check in my little mail slot for $300. And the next day they put another check in the mail slot for $300. And so I had two checks. And I immediately gave one of them back. I said, I think there's a mistake. And they said, oh, there was a mistake. Thank you, and all that. But then I'm reflecting upon it. I thought, you know, years ago, there would have been hesitation. Has anybody mischanged you and given you, you know, you give them $5, they thought you gave them 20 and they give you 15 back or something? That hesitation? Yeah, right? The hesitation? What is that hesitation? In this particular instance, there was no hesitation whatsoever. And I thought, well, that's interesting. It just wasn't there in the system anymore. But I remember a great number of years where there was. And I never begrudged that hesitation. It felt to me like the hesitation was the refrain from the pause, the where the past has such momentum and duration that it leaps forward, and there's that hesitation. Doesn't mean that this is really who we are, is in that dishonest mind of the hesitation. Doesn't mean that at all. All it is the explosion of the past upon the present. And may I say that Dharma practice is all about the past exploding upon the present. That's what it is. And so we have to be very careful that we don't, I really am dishonest at my core because this old feeling comes in. Even as a monk, here I am, tied 243 different preceptual ways. And my mind was just going, out. It was finding a way out of every one of those precepts. The side door. I could go into many. I'll just tell you one brief one where you would get one meal a day, and then that was it. The lay people would then take the food back, and you weren't allowed to store any food. So they'd give you the food. You'd eat as much as you needed, and then they would take the food back. And once they took the food back, it was no longer your food. Plus, you weren't supposed to eat outside of the hours what you ate, which was afternoon, after 12. So my sister sent me this whole thing of chocolate. And so the lay person gave it to me, and I opened it up, and they were like, I can't remember, but let's say 2 pounds. And I said, oh, God. I've got an hour and a half. And so I started at it. And I said, so finally I ate all I could possibly eat, and the time was getting short, and I still had, say, a pound left. I don't remember my time. So I started thinking, they'd never know. Put it on my mattress. But you don't do that, you see. And there's a certain way that just the whole visual representation of taking those, which is what the monk's robes is about. Monk's robes is about a visual representation of renunciation, of just being plain, being simple. That it just plays forth with such obviousness. You see, when we take precepts, it's not obvious that you're taking precepts at all. I mean, how do I know that from before you came into this particular service? But when you're a monk, your living persona is perceptual. And so somehow having that great emphasis, I thought, oh man, the power of sila, the power of taking these vows is so enormous. And so we should make, have a little bracelet. I mean, perhaps I should have had some cords. Often they do power cords. We have a bracelet or around your neck, you just have this, which reminds you, look in the mirror and you see it. Oh, okay. So I'm taking the precepts more seriously. Perhaps we'll do that at the end. Maybe we'll do that at the end so that after we've done the classes, we have something to carry forth from the classes. But the hesitation of the past, I wanted to make sure that we, because the confrontation with the past is the ongoing Dharma student's job. We only have one job, it is. And not to lose ourselves in thoughts that reclaim our old strategies for life, our old sense of manipulation or distortion or dishonesty. It's okay. Those are going to come. Those have to come. Those are not who we are. Those are not who we are. Those are just calls, an echo chamber. There's just a resounding echo from the past. And so the hesitation is going to come, especially when you make a dramatic choice that I am not going to do this, or I'm going to really watch and investigate this particular aspect of myself. I'm going to refrain and really... When you make that kind of determination, the mind will come at you with the past. So I'm not going to drink again, or an alcoholic. Well, it's not going to just let you say that. It's not going to let you do that. And same degree, it's not going to let you get away with anything. It, because the past is how it knows itself. And above all else, you want to be known. That's what you're really giving up when you're taking on the precepts, is your security of knowing who you were. Your relinquishment of an identity that is loathsome as it may have been, it was by far better than not knowing yourself at all. And so we stay on the road of illegitimate action because I can work with it. I'm fine with it. You know, it's not the most comfortable thing, but I'm known by it. So then we take on the precepts and we've taken on a new garment, a new robe of integrity. Now, so first let's talk about what is it that happens within us when we take what is not offered, because we want to focus in on this precept. What is it that happens? How is our mind holding the world in the moment of greed, of a response of contraction around something? Obviously very tight and stressful sense of self. We're probably afraid of what would happen if we didn't take this thing, of how we would have to be hungry or needy or something. So there's a very strong emotional impact in that moment that we're having. And there's an enormous loss of faith. Faith being the absence of control and influence. Our lives, and I really need to spend much more time talking about this in the future, our need to control, our need for influence, our exertion of will upon the moment. And when we're in the mode of contraction, of grasping, of consuming, of taking, there is this pain body of will that is showing itself forth. It's the of control, of wanting to set everything in place and making sure that your plot is well taken care of, your self above all else. And again, Dharma is understanding. It's interesting, Sharon is coming in November to do a non-residential. She just wrote a book on faith, and I was reading the manuscript, and it touched me so deeply, because it's just the willingness not to know, really. That's what faith is. It's not the belief in something, but it's the willingness to relinquish our strong patterns and not have our will so predominant. And so the world is kind of has a kind of ambiguity again. This is a word that keeps coming up in these precepts. And that we work with that ambiguity, and that it must have that ambiguity in order for clarity to come forth. If it doesn't have ambiguity, then it just has will that comes forth. But when there isn't the assertion and the consumption and the need, then we have to kind of figure things out as we go along. It's all in flow. It's all in free fall. And fear and self-concern are the opposite of faith. And envy and covetousness, and jealousy are extensions of the loss of that faith. And when those arise, feelings of covetousness, jealousy, envy, or just an impulse away from taking. Those are the precursor, the feelings that are often arise and which our will and influence is gaining momentum around those painful emotions. You know, it was interesting as a monk, just to give you a different way to live. I want to just mention again about the economic influences on this particular precept. Perhaps more than any other precept. I mean, when we look at our society, I think we'd have to agree that it isn't the most integritous society. And that's not a put down. It's just, okay, let's just look at it here. Let's just see it. And if you think of it, think of it in terms of the market consumerism, of constantly being sold. And that's the think now don't let's not think of it individually, but think of it as a system of energy of which we are raised within this field of energy of, and this is how the energy builds upon itself, is through your neediness and your want and my ability to sell you that want. Then taking is an extension of that conditioning. Taking. And there isn't a lot of real respect for each other's properties. I'm more interested really in how I can sort of get a larger share, more of it. And within the market, I mean, the market doesn't foster really truth-telling. It fosters exaggeration. You know, this is the best shampoo. This is, you know, those kinds of words that obviously are not true. So the whole thing has a kind of, has an energy and a movement. And this is just, it's not a political statement. It's just looking at the forces that we live with. So, okay, that's what we're up against when we face this precept. And our religious institutions, well, my religious institution, perhaps yours did, mine never did, would give a lot of lip service to self-righteousness, but very little to simplicity. Because simplicity was against the movement of energy of consumerism. And our religions, for the most part, are based in mainstream culture. And it can't go against that. But this practice and these precepts are a call towards simplicity. Not to give, not to take, but to relinquish, to give back, to unburden ourselves. And so it is counter to the cultural energy. And that's why it's so difficult to really get our feet and body into this one. I mean, it's into everything, our relationship to the earth, our relationship to each other, our relationship to ourselves. All of that has a huge perceptual direction to it. And so we are battling forces that are enormous within us. Is there any wonder then that there's hesitation? Let our heart come out in that hesitation, not begrudge it, not feel shame because of it, but to say, yes, that's it. There's the past. That's why I feel that way. Of course. Of course. But that doesn't mean that we have to give in to it. It doesn't mean to let the past move through the present gives us a new option in the present. To let the past, let me say that again, to let the past express itself emotionally, vibrationally, energetically, and to be able to hold that past in the present without falling and betraying our integrity. So we just hold it, the impulse, the hesitation, we hold it, allows the present to have new possibilities. How do we think new possibilities come? They don't come in opposition to the past. They come in a complete awareness of the past. And so we're moving this practice, we're moving, and we're just a handful of people in a million, of a city of a million. We're just a handful. Doesn't matter. We're moving in a different direction. And we need canes and props to hold us up. And these precepts are that. These precepts are the props that keep us, okay, on the steady path against the mainstream energy. What does integrity mean? Because that's what we're talking about when we're taking on these precepts. It means the state of being unimpaired. Completeness. The word comes from the same derivative as the word integer. Whole. A whole number. Integer. So, integrity or wholeness is our heart connection. And so we have then the integrity of the heart and the hesitation of the mind. The mind is still moving in the direction of the cultural way it was formed. So we have this energy up here that is constantly going to be looking out and seeking for advantage. And then the heart here that is trying to connect with the integrity and wholeness of who we are. And those two, we have to just enlarge in the heart in a space large enough so that it holds the energy of the mind. Not so that those two are in combat with one another. We're not looking for more tension. We're looking for the release of tension and the acknowledgement of something rather than to be driven by something. So it's not the energy of the mind that we're going to be driven by anymore. And that sometimes brings us into a crisis of within the culture, within our family. It means oftentimes our paths move in opposite direction than the expectation of those we love. And those, because those expectations were formed out of the charged quality of the culture. So we have to be stronger than that. See, it's stronger meaning, more integritous. More integritous meaning, able to hold it. First of all, be able to see that it's catching me up, that I'm constantly wanting to grasp a hold, wanting to acquire, and keep thinking, oh, what am I doing this Buddhist stuff for? I should be out getting more real estate. And sometimes there's a crisis of faith that comes when you really don't know what you're doing this for. Have we had that? I've had that. Then why am I doing this? Because the heart can't speak for itself. Awareness doesn't have any verbiage. Doesn't have any statement. Like the air doesn't speak for itself. It just holds all forms that pass through it. So the heart doesn't have it doesn't have any offsetting dialogue. All the dialogue comes from the mind. But there's an integrity, an ease, that although isn't a dialogue of the mind, is definitely felt and sensed throughout the body. Wholeness of heart. So the mind tries to find that wholeness through acquisition. It says, I'm not whole now, and I'll go out and manipulate the forms of the world and bring them into my sphere of influence, and thereby I will be whole within what I define whole by accumulation. That's how the mind works towards what it thinks is wholeness. But the heart works in a very different way. It works in the opposite direction. It's so interesting. It's like this goes this way and this goes this way. It's like 180 degrees. The heart grows towards simplicity and generosity, not through accumulation and neediness and complexity. And everybody is yelling at you about your comparative and evaluative position in things, and you're sitting there not buying into it. And we think the hurricane's winds are strong. And what we begin to see is that the sense of who I am has been based on that lacking. Been based on that, oh, I need some more. Just whatever it is that I am now, it's not enough. I need more. It's always future-oriented. It's always about what I will have, not what I do have. What I will acquire, what I will assimilate, what I will ingest, and what I will become after all of that has been done. And therefore, we're passing through time in our consuming mentality. But the heart rests. It just rests. Who pays attention to the air? I'm paying attention to the objects I want through the air. And the air is just resting. Who pays attention to the space? Everybody pays attention to the forms and manipulations within that space. Those are the people I want to know. Those are the people I don't want to know. Those are the things I want to possess. Those are the traits I don't want to have. But the heart rests in the space. It rests in the air. And the way the mind, based upon that consumption mentality, to acquire this, for me to acquire that, means that I always have some tension about me. I live with this kind of tension. But to live as the air or the space means I live tensionless. To live with the objects means my relationships to things is based upon will and influence and control. To live with space and the air, awareness, presence, is to live in ambiguity. To live with objects is to live with the greatest sense of identity and need, because need is identity. To live with space and awareness is to live without identity, in simplicity, without need. In meditation, we start with the assumption of wholeness. And we look at the hesitations within that wholeness. Does everyone follow what I mean by the hesitations? The pulls of the mind within that wholeness. Okay. So we sit down. And we fill ourselves with awareness, with the air element. And we let the hesitations move through it. Because the gun keeps firing. It's firing blanks, but it keeps making a lot of noise in there. And the first thing, the first gun that goes off is the desire cannon. And yet it's just, if we trace it back, it's just a feeling. It's just an emotion. It's just a tenacious quality of mind. So if we can bring awareness to the desire, we have uncoupled the sequential direction that desire leads to exploitation and to becoming and to manipulation and to all of that. And if we just hold the desire, okay, wanting this. You ever had an addiction? You just hold it. And for 20 minutes you say, okay, I'm not going to get up here. I'm just not going to get up. See, that's integrity. That's the willingness to place ourselves on the line. Okay, I'm just not going to get up here. I'm wanting, but I'm just not going to get up. And it's through that confidence, it's through that experience that confidence grows and we become unshakable. What can move us? Maybe next week's talks on sexual desire. Maybe that's that's the one that seems to have the last and most tenacious hold. So what... See, this thing of taking, it's not just about stealing. Most of us are beyond our willingness to steal. And as a monk, I could have put my most valuable possessions, whatever they were as a monk, right on the path, my bowl, on a path, and gone away for a week. And then all that would have happened to it would have been, it would have been set to the side or maybe carried to my kuti, my little hut, but nobody would have taken it. And nobody would do that. You just would not do that. I mean, have we... So I've actually lived in a place where the culture is that, holds that kind of integrity. That's amazing. That's really amazing. So we just need to work with that one. Okay, so let's just play with it. You know, everybody else is going to be taking, but we have to be strong enough that we just say, okay, let me just play around with that one. Let me just experience a form of my own integrity where I won't take. And when we borrow something, you know, so some of these infractions, just listen to some of the infractions now. You know, when we borrow something, well, we like the book, right? We really like having the book at our house. He'll never remember who he loaned it to. I've lost so many books. Good books. Or taking advantage of someone. That's a taking, isn't it? To take only what is offered. Now listen to this, because this was actually emailed to me by a friend, but I thought it was so lovely, this particular perception, and the most subtle form of this precept. Now remember the precept, to take only what is offered. To take only what is offered. How do we, in the moment, as the moment's arising, right? Can we take just what is offered in this moment? And what does that mean in terms of our bare attention to this moment? In terms of this second precept, you see, the subtleties of the taking what is not offered, what is not here now. How do we manipulate this moment to fit our needs and thereby rob it of its integrity, of its wholeness. And the meditation is to bring just bare attention on this moment, just to be with this moment. And add nothing to it. And thereby be with it just with what it's being offered. Isn't that a beautiful... So this week, how about using, if you think that you're pretty complete in the other forms of this precept, what about that one? Isn't that the ultimate meaning of renunciation? To go naked into the moment? To add nothing to it? To renounce adding anything to the moment? And isn't that the ultimate interpretation? The ultimate meaning of the monk's robes? The simplicity of their outfit is meant to bring that same sense of relinquishment to the moment. Not to have to give away things. It really is not about things. It's not about things. Whether you have things or don't have things. Simplicity is not about things. Simplicity is about our relationship to things. And that has to do with how we hold the moment. Because if we hold the moment for just what it is, it can be full and abundant with the simplest cry of the hawk or the touch of the breeze. And when it is impoverished, it can be impoverished in the middle of Bill Gates' home. We think of renunciation as having to do with giving up. But what about right now, how we hold this moment? With the siren. Just this. Would you want something better? You see, when we rise to the space of completion, we leave objects behind. Presence or absence means nothing. What difference does it make? Because we're not focused on acquisition. Our minds aren't going out and saying, oh, this thing. Because everything arises together. It's all complete just as it is, as it arises together. And we add nothing to who we are because we're complete as it arises as well. Even with the pause, even with the hesitation. And that's what it means when it says we are moving towards purity. Purity of heart. Purity of allowing things to be just as they are. And that's the real spirit of this second precept. Thank you.